Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell Reed, my co-host Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Melody Crow. Each week, we visit with a local author or other artists, try to get an introduction to their work and a glimpse into their lives. We ask them what prompts them to write and give them an opportunity to hear them read from their work. We're delighted to have Melody Crow with us on a return visit to Word on the Hills. Bonjour and welcome, Melody. Melody Crow is an elder of Alderville First Nation and has lived in that community all her life. She studied at Trent University, and in 2007 she received a Lifetime Achievement Award for the preservation of language and culture from the Union of Ontario Indians. She's worked tirelessly for the preservation of the Ojibwe culture and language for more than 22 years and is currently First Nation Education Liaison for Kawartha Pine Ridge District School Board. Through her company OnDeg Productions, she has produced a variety of materials dedicated to creating a deeper understanding and appreciation of First Nation culture, knowledge, language, and wisdom. Her most recent project is a documentary film called What We Want You to Know. Spirit of the Hills Festival Committee was thrilled that Melody agreed to give a workshop at Spirit of the Hills Festival of the Arts on November the 4th. It was sold out, and Melody kindly accepted 3 extra participants. So, it is very nice to see you again.
Lovely to see you.
Languages are under threat all over the world, and many people like you are working very hard to preserve them. What do the owners of the language lose when their languages are suppressed, as they were in the residential schools? And what do all of us lose when a language becomes extinct?
Oh, well, we lose an entire worldview. Within our indigenous languages, it's a direct connection to identity, to culture, to ways in which a people views the world around them. So values are held in language, beliefs, philosophies, connections to the land. So if a language becomes extinct, even when we lose a fluent elder or a fluent speaker, that worldview and that knowledge connected within that also goes with them.
Yes. And what about for the rest of us? We do lose, we lose something too. Everybody loses something in the world when one of our languages disappears.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Well, I think we lose, you know, an understanding maybe or a connection with that because we're so tied with our languages.
Yes, yeah. And an alternative view of the world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right.
You know, a glimpse into another way of looking at the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's said that Inuit languages have more than 52 words for snow.
Yeah.
Do you think that a language is always so closely connected to our surroundings and to the lives we lead? Can you give us some examples from your own language?
Yes, I can, and I do. I definitely think language is closely connected to our surroundings and reflects those surroundings and the lives that we lead. It reflects our ways, again, of looking at the world. Some examples within my Anishinaabe language. So the word for rainbow is Nimki Nabkawagan, and that's the word rainbow, but it really translates into the Thunderer's Necklace. So that's, you know, when you think about that, isn't that lovely?
It is.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yes. And yes. A butterfly is Wapona, and that Wapona is the one that lands softly. So another nice one. Our word for mother, Dodom. And Dodom is the one, the nurturer, you know, that one who nurtures. Medicine is Mishkiki. And our word for medicine translates into strength from the land. And so when you think about those medicines, you know how they would have traditionally come from the earth and from that land, right? So it's like getting strength from the land.
The most beautiful language.
Yes, yes.
Yes, and so our descriptive.
Yeah. Things. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Even a young man. So the word for young man is shkinwe. And really what that means is a new sound. So just as a boy is going into a, you know, a young man and that, and they have that change in their voice, right? It's, so it's a new sound.
Right.
Yeah. And then one more, I chose one more, which was the word for town, like going into town. And that's Odana. And Odana really means a place of many hearts because it has that word heart in it, Odana. Yeah, so it's really kind of nice when you really can look at the language in that way, right, and that actual translation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is lovely.
Yeah.
Mm. So what steps should we take to preserve and expand the use of Indigenous languages? Are young people able to study Ojibwe in school in this area?
Yeah.
And do they become fluent?
Well, you know, I think there's always that goal of working towards fluency. And we do have some young folks that are really studying hard and, you know, working on that. But I think it's important, too, to just value any bit of language that they're learning. Yeah. And that's one of the things I try to encourage, is that every bit of language that is being learned is important to hold on to, and it keeps that language alive. Mm-hmm. And so the young people do get it in schools. Three of our elementary schools within the KPR school board offers it from junior kindergarten to grade 8. And then at the high schools where those students go on to offer the language. And that's been happening now for many years in the schools. Our community of Alderville offers it at daycare level. And I've been teaching it in adult classes since 1991 within Alderville community. But I think every step that we can take to preserve the language, you know, and to engage learners, I guess, is a big thing, to find ways that engages. And so even today, you know, you're seeing more things like language apps, because everybody's using their phones and technology, mm-hmm. and so there's apps that are being created. I've joined the world of Twitter for the last year. I finally joined the world of Twitter, and so I've been tweeting out an Anishinaabe word a week. So I do that every Wednesday. I put out a word of the week, and I've actually gained quite a few followers just by doing that. So just, you know, joining in, I think, by using today's ways, I guess, of engaging people.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do you hope one day that, well, of course, because there are so many, perhaps it's difficult, but shouldn't Indigenous languages have the same status as French, for instance, and English as official languages?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things I certainly believe, that it should have the same status.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that would allow people to use it in the outside world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Just at home.
Absolutely. So any encouragement, you know, to do things to preserve it and to engage people, I guess, is ways that we're going to find to keep that going and to increase that empowerment in the learners and in our own people, too, who've lost that language, you know, to no fault of their own, you know, given the history that we've gone through
indeed.
Over the years.
Yes. So what other ways can society encourage greater use of the Indigenous languages, do you think?
I think really just kind of what you were saying, I think more so by valuing the Indigenous languages as equals to English and French, mm-hmm. you know. And I was thinking in terms of, like really, North America is the homeland of our First Nation people. And so these languages that we're speaking about are the original languages mm-hmm. of this North America mm-hmm. in true sense. And the negative ripples that of over 100 years of residential schools within our Canadian history has more than impacted our First Nation people and direct decline in the number of speakers that we have. So residential schools forbid use of our languages, and we're known for that infamous saying and the goal of to kill the Indian in the child.
Yeah.
And so creating awareness like we're doing today can make all the difference in encouraging society to support and value any initiatives that are connected to our First Nation languages, I believe, as a result of that.
Yes, well, I hope that makes more progress, because we have had progress, haven't we?
Oh, yes.
You've been teaching the language since 1991.
Yeah, it's a long time.
We are making some progress.
Absolutely, and seeing it lasting in the schools, and the support in the school system is really just continuing to grow, you know. In fact, one of the, in the last couple of years, but again this year it's offered at a school in Peterborough one night a week for students who don't receive language, Ojibwe language, in their schools, for example. So if they want to take it, they can take it. Yeah, they can go to a night class. And I think that's an awesome initiative.
Yes.
You know, like, and that was actually, you know, born out of a request from parents.
Hmm.
So it's nice. And we're seeing non-native children also signing up for those classes.
Yes. So you produced a version of a beautiful book, Where Fires Dance, which incorporates words and phrases in Ojibwe. Could you read to us from that book?
Sure. And the book, Where Fires Dance, is actually a story by Alison Clark and Eric Howe. And Alison, many, many moons back, she was one of the coordinators of the Black Oak Savannah in Alderville. And so this story of Where Fires Dance is actually kind of a story that she's written to kind of tell the story through these little characters about how that prairie land and the savanna, like, you know, thrives, and more or less that's the story about it. And I was asked to enhance it just with some Ojibwe words throughout it.
Yes.
So I can share a little bit of that.
Yes, that would be lovely.
Okay, so I'm just going to do one little part here. Badgers know that WASI, animal predators, are not the only threat to the life on the savanna. Not all of the people who live here today came to hunt caribou or Wawashkaji, the deer. Others came later on wooden ships from across the ocean. They cleared Matigok, the trees, from the savannas and plowed up great areas of Mushkoda, prairie grasslands, to create pastures for their livestock and fields for their crops. The logs were sent away to make more wooden ships so that more people could come. Also to protect their homes and livestock, these people stopped the fires from dancing. Soon most of Akeh, the land, was covered with fields of wheat, madaman, corn, and pinig, potatoes, and pastures for Bajagojik, the horses, Tikwug, the cows, and Montanisug, the sheep. Only small scattered patches of tall grass Mushkoda, prairie, and oak savanna remained. These remnants faced many challenges. Without fire, Matigok, the trees and shrubs, crowded the open grasslands. The newly introduced plants and Wasiug, animals brought by the new people, competed with the original native plants and Wasiug, animals for medium, food, and space. Before long, Akeh, the land, could no longer support all of the plants and Wasiug, those animals, whose home had been the prairies and savannas. Then the disappearing act began. The blue lupin, Wawaskona, the flower, made an early departure. Wasiug animals that relied on the blue lupin, like the Carner blue and Perseus duskywing, Waponeug, butterflies, were soon to follow. Most of the badgers have had to move far away as well, one by one, and then two by two, and three by three. Plants and Wasiug animals vanished from the savanna. The badger cub paused, looked at Edward, and said, "Negitsimuk, my parents told me this story just as I'm telling it to you."
That was lovely. So it's a story of the Black Oak Savanna.
Yes, and so Where the Fires Dance was basically when they used to, you know, like burn that, have a prescribed burn.
Well, presumably they now do it again.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And it's a beautiful place to visit.
Yes.
And everybody's welcome to visit there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Melody. We've been talking with Melody Crow, a documentary filmmaker and producer of a variety of materials dedicated to creating a deeper understanding and appreciation of First Nation culture, knowledge, language, and wisdom. Now we'll take a short break.